Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of The Bird Calls. I am your host, David Grubb, alongside our basketball analyst for both Hard in the Paint Sports and The Bird Rights, Ben Pfeiffer. Ben, we haven't talked on the show in a while, but glad to have you back.
It's been a minute. Yeah, thanks for having me. You know, we obviously talk plenty, but it's good to do it, you know, on live. So
we are at that part of the season, only 3 games left. The Pelicans finishing out this road trip with a back-to-back that starts tonight in Sacramento against the Kings. Obviously, this is a huge game. The Pelicans holding on to the sixth spot as we record and going into tonight's game, and they have the three of the four teams immediately behind them. That's who they finished their season with. A Sacramento team they're 4-0 against. A Golden State team that has not been great at home this season, and then finishing up at home against the Lakers, who have been resurgent as of late. As we go into these last three games first, before we talk about tonight's matchup, what do you feel about the Pelicans' position right now, and how safe do you feel that they're going to avoid the play-in, which has been a very huge critical goal for them this season?
Yeah, the play-in avoidance thing is... it's huge. At this point, I think I'd feel pretty solid about them. They are in that sixth seed right now. Obviously, I think they're like a half game ahead of the Suns, who they fortunately were able to beat finally. But I don't know. It's going to be huge, like with these last couple games. Like if they can beat the Lakers and the Warriors, then they're going to be in.
Yeah. It starts with this Sacramento game tonight. As we know, the Pelicans have had a lot of success against Sacramento this year, 4-0. It would be kind of unprecedented since the 30-team era in particular for a team to beat somebody 5 times during the regular season. And the Pelicans in particular, not only have they beaten the Kings, they've played their best basketball probably against any team against the Kings. They score 126 points a game. They're plus 21 over the 4 games. They shoot the ball incredibly well from every distance. But they do the things that the Pelicans really do well. We'll get into the three-pointers in particular, but why have they been so successful against the Kings this year?
Yeah, I think the Kings' defense is kind of perfectly, I guess, not equipped to deal with what the Pelicans have. The Kings have definitely been better on defense this year. I think over the last 15 games, they've been a pretty solid unit overall. But given that their biggest weaknesses are, you know, kind of similar to the Pelicans, they don't have a reliable guy who's protecting the rim, who's limiting good shots there. So Jonas Valanciunas can eat in the post there. Zion and Ingram and CJ can all get downhill and create great shots against that defense. And that, it's just not a great team. On the defensive end, I should say. The emergence of Keon Ellis for the Kings has been a big story for them lately. He's been kind of a revelation as, like, they finally have a real guard outside of Fox who can defend and shoot threes. Like, obviously, they drafted Davion Mitchell to do that a couple years ago, and he unfortunately hasn't been that guy for them. But Keon has provided some really useful guard defense for them that I think has been one of the reasons that their defense has been so impactful lately. But still, I think the Pelicans, with how much they can just like bludgeon you inside, are a team that is very well, that generally are pretty well equipped to destroy what the Kings have. They're going to shoot a bunch in the paint. They're going to get good looks, and the Kings just don't have much on their roster in terms of stopping that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and then you take away on the perimeter, you take away Kevin Herter and Malik Monk. Malik Monk was likely your sixth man of the year, the way he was playing, and just such a dynamic player, not only with his ability to shoot the three, but to take it to the basket, to finish at the rim dynamically.
He's like exactly the player I wish the Pelicans had.
He'd be perfect. That's the kind of bench scorer that the Pelicans need, a guy who just creates opportunities for himself and others. 16 points, 5 assists, great finisher around the bucket, and gives you defensive intensity. You'd love for the Pelicans to have a guy like that. Maybe Jordan Hawkins doesn't have the athleticism of a Malik Monk. Close. But maybe he can develop into a guy who can score and create for others off the bench in that manner. But
yeah, that's certainly the hope with picking him in the lottery. So,
but as you talked about, the inside battle is one that I think people really need to pay attention to. Jonas Valanciunas, who has gotten this decrease in minutes as the Pelicans have relied on small ball as of late, he feasts against the Kings, averaging 15 points, 12 boards, 65% shooting against the Kings this year, and he's held Sabonis. Domantas Sabonis below all of his season averages when they play against each other. It's clear that Jonas's physicality is a problem for Sabonis.
Yeah, and on the Pelicans' defensive end, Herb and Dyson specifically have been two of the best De'Aaron Fox defenders in the league this year. Fox is used to being able to get wherever he wants with his speed and his handle, and he's reverted a bit. Like he's shot more pull-ups and more jumpers this year than he ever has in the past, but especially against the Pelicans in the past games, with Dyson Daniels and Herb Jones on the floor, they can have one of those just hound him at the point of attack, disrupt his rhythm, not let him get anything. And obviously you have the other one, usually Herb Jones, just hawking and lurking as a help defender like he does. But yeah, the Pelicans, their defense certainly has limits, but on the whole, it's been a pretty strong unit this year, and they're very well equipped to guard these like guard oriented teams like the Kings. Sabonis is a problem for every team pretty much. He's a monster, and he might make all NBA for another year for a reason, right? But there are other offensive options I think the Pelicans have a lot of answers for.
Yeah, the thing we have not seen this year, when the Pelicans play the Kings, typically one of the guys who usually goes off is Harrison Barnes. He's not had that impact this year because of that length and the defensive ability of the Pelicans perimeter, especially when you talk about Dyson Daniels and Herb Jones playing together. That grouping, along with Zion and Trey, we've seen, and Jonas, that five-man group has been very effective throughout the season, though it hasn't had a ton of minutes, but it's played more than 60 minutes as a group together. That group in particular, they match up exceptionally well against this Kings team.
Yeah, absolutely. I think playing that like fast ball with the physical presence as well inside is just really, really impressive. Yeah, but it's been really good. I'm looking at it right now. Jonas's most common matchup this season has been Domantas Sabonis. He's guarded him for 33 minutes this year. He's done a pretty solid job overall. And that's, I think, having that guy who obviously Jonas has his defensive issues, especially against teams that run a ton of pick and rolls. But the Kings don't run a lot of pick and rolls. They run a lot of post-ups. They run a lot of handoffs. And Valanciunas is much better suited to guard that type of action where he can be a disruptor in the paint with his size and his length and his strength. So, yeah, I definitely think as he has been all season, he'll be a fact. He'll be an important factor for this too.
The other thing that I think is very important in this game defensively and offensively for the Pelicans in particular is that, there's been this conversation, and we'll get deeper into it, about three-pointers, because I think people are misinterpreting the conversation because, quite frankly, social media is a horrible place to have any type of nuanced discussion. Pelicans, when we talk about three-pointers generally, and I think this is the case for you, and please tell me if I'm wrong, it's not just a number. It's not just a raw number of you must shoot these attempts. It's not just a raw number of makes. There are numbers that certainly show that you have to be in this area generally to have success. Because even when you look at the Pelicans against the Kings, they only average around 12 makes three made threes a game, and they only shoot around 33 or 34 threes a game against the Kings. But it's because of the way that they get those shots. It's the flow of it. They do a lot of inside out when Jonas is on the floor. Zion is able to drive downhill and create. B.I., who was averaging almost 25 points a game against the Kings, was able to get into all three level scoring because the Kings defensively have no real one-on-one defender to match up with anybody on that Pelican starting five. So when you look at that, I think this is another great matchup offensively for the Pelicans to get the kinds of shots that they want, particularly from distance, because we saw they didn't shoot a great percentage against Portland the other night from three. They only made 11 three-pointers, five of those from CJ, five of those from Trey Murphy. But the most of the attempts until late stage of the game came in the flow of the offense.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's backed up by the numbers, right? I mean, across the season, the Pelicans are what I think in the bottom half or, you know, the bottom 10 in the league in 3-point attempts, but they're in the top 10 in 3-point percentage. They very much pick their spots when it comes to taking those threes. And sometimes I wish they would take more or look for them more, because they can get such good looks off their driving kick offense, off their, you know, curl flow, second side stuff to get CJ coming around screens, to get Trey open in early offense, especially obviously when Hawkins plays, he's a big threat from out there. And yeah, I think especially like you said, the one-on-one defense. Like I said, Keon Ellis is a pretty good one-on-one defender. Keegan Murray can do it as well, but he's like the only guy. You know, you're going to have three or four wings who can hopefully put the ball on the floor and get downhill, and that's been a really good source of offense. And I want to go quickly mention one more defensive stat that I was alluding to. So Dyson Daniels this year, his second most common matchup is De'Aaron Fox. Across four games, six, according to NBA.com, across four games and 67 possessions, he's held De'Aaron Fox to 9 points on 30% shooting. That's pretty ridiculous. And I think the film backs up, right?
Remember again, he's exactly 19. He's the youngest player on the Pelicans roster.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And I think Daniels obviously has a long way to go on offense, and in some matchups that makes it harder for him to see the floor. But in one like this where he's shown like, hey, there is this star player who I am very good at defending, and I have, you know, just his style, his lateral quickness is pretty unique for someone his size, 6'7" and strong. I think that gives a guy like Fox problems. Most players as tall as Dyson, De'Aaron Fox can just blow right by. He's, you know, one of the quickest and fastest players in the league, and one of the, you know, he's an all-star for a reason, but Dyson has given him trouble all year. I know Herb has also given him trouble this year as well. And I just find that to be very impressive for a guy. Yeah. For someone who is, you know, barely able to like legally drink in this country, against an all-star. It's pretty cool.
We got to give Dyson credit just in general. You know, he missed those games. He comes back his first couple games. He was really rusty as far as his offense is gone. But we've seen a more aggressive Dyson Daniels by necessity, of course, because when you're missing 20 plus points per game in the form of Brandon Ingram, if you're going to come in, you cannot be shy about shooting the basketball. But what we've seen, too, is I think, you know, you still see the confusion for Dyson. And part of that, I think, is it's really hard to get a role in this offense when you're, especially for certain guys. I don't think he understands if he's a one, a two, or a three offensively sometimes. I think, you know, obviously he's much more, I think we'd view him as a connector, as a passer, yeah. But a guy who's showing that if you get him in that corner, he's willing to take that corner three. And if he's working on that floater, he just doesn't get some of the chances that we saw in summer league and in the G League to play in that mid post and those types of areas, because it's occupied. But I think the growth for Dyson from last year to this year is obvious. And I think that you're seeing that he is, you know, like advanced numbers aside, I know people think that, you know, we go too far with that, but you just watch him on the court and the team moves better on both ends of the floor when he's there.
Yeah. And honestly, I think the main thing that I want to see Dyson keep on improving is just his overall confidence as an offensive player. Like, there are times when he will be shooting the ball and he'll be driving, and, you know, it's not perfect. He'll miss shots. He'll take bad shots. But he's, you know, a super young second-year player. I think the worst of it comes when Dyson will get an open look, or he'll have a driving lane and he'll back out and he'll try to reset, or he won't take his opportunity, because then the whole flow of the offense shuts down. Yes. So like, I would rather him, you know, like take those shots, grow on the fly, you know, take those open threes, because like I said, he's improving as a shooter. Dyson as well is shooting, it's low volume, but he's shooting just above 49% from mid-range, which is really, really good considering his limited attempts. So he can get into the paint and he can, you know, hit that little floater and turn around and pull up game. It's just about, I think for him, it's just about being confident about searching for those looks, and about, you know, being okay with misses and being okay with playing for those. And I think that's going to come, you know, he's still an extremely young player. And I think what we've seen is great for him so far.
And he's also, I mean, I'd hesitate. He's one of the Pelicans' top four rebounders as far as natural ability and statistically. Like, he rebounds like a front court player. And yeah, the Pelicans don't have a lot of people who can do that and turn it end to end once they get the ball.
Yeah, his motor is always evident, right? Like, he's always moving. He's always trying to impact the game in a positive way. And even if that, you know, that's not always – it doesn't always work, or it's not always like, okay, it doesn't always, you know, it doesn't always result in good outcomes, but it's the process, I think, is absolutely correct in the way that he's approaching the game, in the way that he's trying to learn. And I have a stat for you real quick that's relating to those rebounds. So of all first and second year players that are guards, Dyson is fourth in offensive rebounding rate and fifth in defensive rebounding rate. So just to back up what you're saying, right, the numbers do support it, that when Dyson's on the floor, the Pelicans are grabbing rebounds. And I think it's impressive because, like, he's not the most explosive athlete ever. He's a good athlete, but he's not like, for example, someone like Amen Thompson, who is by far first in both, like one of the most explosive athletes in the league, or like Shaedon Sharpe. For, you know, someone who hasn't played much this year because of injury, but crazy explosive, Dyson's, you know, able to use his positioning and his feel for the game to get those boards. And I think it's really impressive that he does that.
And he's stronger than he looks, too.
Oh, he is super strong. Super strong.
He's a very hard player to move. The guy who's had the task of filling in for Brandon Ingram, of course, is Trey Murphy in the starting lineup. As a starter, the last 10 games or so, he's averaging about 16 points per game. But his three-point shooting has been the concern. He's just over 33% from distance. And this is a guy who last year was a 50-40-90 guy, essentially, in his second year. I think the biggest concern for Trey, and a lot of people are saying that this is evidence that he's not a starter, I don't think that that's the case. I think he is hurt by the Pelicans' failure to have enough ball handlers on the floor and their lack of adherence to the James Borrego offensive principles.
Yeah, I think at the moment he's just a little bit overtaxed, which, I mean, like you said, shouldn't be a slight for a third-year 23-year-old who has shown the kind of stuff as an off-ball scorer that he has. Trey has not been, like, a super experienced ball handler pretty much ever. Even going back to his time at Virginia, he played like a totally off-ball role, and that's what he's been asked to do at the NBA level, at least until this season, right, where they're asking him to try to ball handle a little more and to make plays. And while he's had some decent moments doing that, I think that's understandably going to lead to a dip in efficiency. And that being said, right, like, he is still very efficient relative to wings across the league, just not by his standard. He's a much better mid-range shooter than he was last year. Obviously, he's gotten more opportunities there this year, but he's been more efficient in that area. So I think there's definitely been progression, but it's not to the point where, like, you could have him replacing what Ingram gave you, right? Obviously, because Ingram is, you know, a very legitimate ball handler and creator for a 6'7" guy when Trey Murphy is, you know, and Ingram wasn't this guy in his third year, right? And neither is Trey. But I do agree that if you have Trey on the floor, I think, like, you want him taking a lot of threes and you want him getting easy open looks. And he's had a couple pretty impressive games recently, right? Like that, what, he had 31 against Portland where he hit five threes. I think he hit four threes against Phoenix in the loss. So yeah, I think just continuing to get him buckets in the flow of the offense, and you know, I guess trying to rely on Zion and CJ and the others to have the ball in their hands. But you know, it's also not. Hopefully, this experience ends up being good for him in the long term. You know, like hopefully he ends up learning how to do this and can take on a more on-ball role in the future, because he's, you know, he flashes the ability to dribble and to make some decisions, but it's just not consistent right now.
And we know he can finish at the rim. We know he has the athletic ability to finish at the rim. And we've seen his confidence in his body grow, and his willingness to go, you know, two hands and try to finish with authority. We see him go in now a lot harder. And I think some of those things, when you miss a third of the season, you know, due to injury, I think it is hard to find your place in that group. And then the way it's gone and the natural problems that the Pelicans have in this roster. But the biggest concern for me, for Trey and for this whole team, is the goal was to get more below the break threes offensively. And we watch on a night-to-night basis. You look at that shot chart. The Pelicans are still at the bottom of the league amongst teams who shoot corner threes. And those attempts have not, you know, they're not consistent from night to night, especially for guys like Herb Jones, who has become a knockdown corner three-point shooter. Trey Murphy should be getting four or five attempts in the corner every night just on movement. Dyson Daniels, that's the spot that he needs to learn. That has to be his shot. The guys who are above the break, your Jordan Hawkins, your CJ McCollums, who are coming off those types of screens and ending up beyond the break, sure. But your snipers, the guys who you really need to be your volume shooters, particularly in those ways, the offense just has not created those looks.
Yeah, no. And I think that's part of like, that's been part of like the, they've asked Trey to do more like above the break stuff, bringing the ball up and to mix results. Like, again, I remember a play against like the Clippers, I think recently, where that, like, I think it's emblematic of how much better he's gotten at attacking closeouts off the ball, like the below the break stuff, right? I think he caught it on like the deep wing and someone closed out and he did a little Euro step and dropped it off to a cutter. And it's like, that's the stuff I want to see Trey doing. And yeah, hopefully getting those looks. But I do think it's interesting that Trey has been one of the better pull-up shooters, especially among wings this year. He's shooting almost 40% on pull-up threes on a pretty decent, you know, amount of attempts. So I wonder if they want to, you know, if Trey is going to keep getting these on-ball minutes, because obviously, like, the pull-up three-point shooting has been something that Ingram specifically has struggled to do consistently throughout his entire career. So maybe like that could be a way to lean into Trey if they have to use him as a ball handler, be like, give him a screen, make someone fight over and just say, let it rip. Like, cause that's been really successful this season, especially, but across his career.
Well, the guy who's also had to take on a much bigger load as of late is CJ McCollum. You know, this month alone in April, he's averaging 39.1 points minutes per game. He's played in
39 points is crazy.
Yeah, 39.1 minutes, but he's been over 40 minutes in three of the last eight games. He's playing more minutes. His minutes have gone up every month since January. 29.8 in January, 30.7 February, 32.6 in March, and now 39.1 in April. And yes, obviously it's a very small size, only five games in April, but at 32 years of age, this again, I think it shows this is not about CJ, because CJ's been playing actually phenomenally during this stretch.
Oh, yeah. He's had just across this season, he's been honestly probably better than he was last year. Like, he's been significantly better than he was last year, I'd say. Like,
I don't understand the criticism, especially last 10 games, leads the team in scoring, 25 points a game, leads the team in assists, overall plus minus. And ranking fourth in the NBA over the last 10 games in made threes, 11th three-point percentage, shooting 44.1%. And you see a lot of buzz, like a lot of times, and this is why, you know, again, when you're watching games, people say, well, we can't have CJ chucking so much. Like, there are ways that CJ gets into trouble offensively. We know this, pounding the ball sometimes, not looking for the right matchup, maybe, you know, getting himself into some awkward shots. But generally this season, he's taken better shots, better quality shots than, as you pointed out, any time at any point in his career. But I think it shows how thin the Pelicans are in the backcourt. Because, yes, he's going to have to play more minutes in the postseason. You shorten your bench. But for CJ right now to be playing 39 minutes a game is a lot.
Yeah, and I think, like, it's not his ideal role, but I give him a ton of credit for how well he's adapted, especially after last year where CJ had a bit of a down year in terms of efficiency. He wasn't particularly impactful, like as a shot creator. But this year, he's been up. And another fun stat is among players who have run at least 100 pick and rolls this year, or you know, according to Synergy, have possessions as the ball handler, which is 120. CJ is 11th in efficiency, behind guys just like Shea and Paul George and Luka and Halliburton and Booker, and ahead of guys like Jalen Brunson and Kawhi Leonard and Jamal Murray and Dame. And obviously that's not everything, but I think it is indicative of how good he's been handling the ball and doing it himself. And even that being said, it's like, it would be great if we could get someone else to do it more. And like the fact that he's been able to do what the Pelicans need him to do is great. But it's like, to hit their ceiling, I think it would still be good for him to be able to do his thing off the ball, which he's been phenomenal at his entire career, right? Going back to playing off Dame 10 plus years ago.
Do you feel like sometimes there's just the players? Look, the Pelicans have a lot of good players. There's no denying that. But it feels as if the guys who fit certain things, the Pelicans have a really hard time getting him on the floor at the right time or at the same time. Because like you, as you pointed out, CJ is a phenomenal pick and roll player. He always has been. He and Dame, that's all they ran pretty much, was pick and roll for a decade. But down here, he's not getting the same type of opportunities to run that pick and roll. Now he is, because there's no real choice but to let him handle the ball in those situations.
Right, he's got to do it. That's his
– But, I mean, you know, we know Zion plays – his best when the tempo is higher, when the defensive intensity is going, and they are not, it's not just running to be running. It's everything, the pace, the movement of the ball in the half court, getting Zion on the move himself so that he's not in a standstill position attacking the defense. Those things, it just feels like there are a lot of Pelicans who do things individually well, but some of them are redundant skill sets that don't match with other players because they're incomplete. When we talk about the reserves, and then you have starters who don't have necessarily complementary skill sets for the kind of offense they want to consistently run.
I think my main issue has always been, at least offensively, that, well, first of all, that the Pelicans, four of their five starters, assuming it's, you know, CJ, Zion, Ingram, Jonas, Herb, are neutral at best defenders, right? Like, they might have guys like, you know, even like Ingram or Valanciunas have utility in some matchups, but they're not, I don't think anyone's arguing that they're good or great defenders. And none of, aside from probably Zion, none of them are like, and this extends to the whole roster, like great or elite passers. I think Ingram's passing has been a lot better this season, but it's still limited, right? He's still like his best passing out of like the second side 21 Chicago actions and when he has the ball in his hand. Zion's obviously done really well as the quote-unquote point guard, but like I feel like to some extent if you're not having him just like running to the rim and shooting, you're losing a little bit of value. So that's my main, like you said, it's like the connective skills, the stuff that adds up when players are not on the ball. And I think that's like when the team is fully healthy is what CJ is so good at, and why part of why he's been so great this year is because that's like what he does. He doesn't need the ball in his hands to impact. He's going to shoot. He's going to pass the ball well, especially as his career has developed. And I am just very curious to see how this works in the playoffs, because like it's crazy to me that this is going to be the first year, hopefully, that we're going to see this full healthy core in the playoffs. And maybe this, you know, the ability to get buckets and be physical in the playoffs is going to end up working and mattering. Or maybe the lack of passing and some of the fit, especially with the bench guys, like they have a lot of like defensive minded energy wings. So maybe it's not going to work. But yeah, I think we're going to learn a lot about the limits of this roster within the next couple weeks. That's for sure.
My thing about the Pelicans all year has been, on any given night, and I don't say this in the NBA sense of the term, on any given night, they can beat anybody in this league. They are that talented enough to do it. But in a seven-game series, I think that their disadvantages are so much easier to exploit because I think they have disadvantages in roster construction. I think they have disadvantages in that their coaching philosophy has not meshed, that there still seems to be a disconnect in what Willie Green wants to do, what James Borrego wants to do, and what the players want to do at times. And then I think that there's the inability, quite frankly, to win home games, to be a 21-win home team, is something frightening when you go into the playoffs, because we know the teams that win championships, the teams that go deep into the playoffs, typically are winning 70% of their home games. And the Pelicans are barely above 500 team at home and are going to be underdogs most likely in their last home game of the season against the Lakers.
Yeah, I absolutely agree that the Pelicans are frustrating at times because of how obviously good and talented they are. And when things are clicking, when they're, you know, defending really hard, when they're playing within the flow of the offense, when Zion is at his peak, then like they can really be anybody, but they can also lose to anyone. Like they are not a team that's going to like, or, you know, they'll lose to the Spurs. They'll play close to like the Blazers and stuff. And early, but it's like, the great teams, and I think this is common with like a lot of the second tier contenders in the league. Like, I think this is true of Sacramento, this is true of Phoenix. Like, in a seven game series, like, there are absolutely exploitable ways that you can game plan for them. And maybe that's true of every West team, except for like the Nuggets or the Timberwolves to some extent. But yeah, I think it's gonna be really interesting. We've obviously been doing playoff previews. Because I think the Pelicans are a pretty matchup dependent team in terms of playoff success. Like if they get a team like the Kings, or even I think a team like the Clippers, who they can have some success with, or I think Phoenix, you know, not a team that runs a ton of spread pick and roll. They run a lot of isolation, don't have a lot of great rim defense. That could be a really good matchup for the Pelicans. But if the Pelicans get a team like OKC or something that runs a lot of that, you know, fast spread pick and roll offense with a great defense, then it could be challenging. But it's going to be a lot of pressure, and we'll really see how things fall with Willie Green and the staff and the players and how they're able to game plan. And obviously, I think more critically, make adjustments, because your game plan is not going to be perfect, right? There's going to be issues. How can you adjust to those on a game by game basis and like within the games themselves?
The last thing I want to end on is, because this has been such a hot debate on social media, is the discussion about the Pelicans with and without Brandon Ingram. And, you know, I don't want to engage in the silly parts of it, but I do want to make sure that I think that people understand where I'm coming from. And I'll let you talk about where you come from in a second.
Yeah,
there's no question in my mind that the Pelicans are a better team this year with Brandon Ingram. That's not an argument. I don't think anyone with a brain is debating that. Yes, the Pelicans are better having Brandon Ingram with them. I think the question that I think we're in a position to have to look at as analysts is that we can't just look at this year. We have to look at down the road and the future of this team and how pieces come together. And when you look at the fact that Zion and B.I. are 4 years apart in age, when you look at the fact that Brandon is up for a very big salary boost when you have CJ under contract, when Zion is in the beginnings of his extension, when you do have Trey Murphy about to come up for another deal, you're losing Jonas most likely in free agency, because I can't imagine a scenario where he decides to come back considering how he's been utilized the last 2 years. You're going to lose Najee Marshall in free agency because you just can't afford to keep a guy on the bench like that with the money that you are spending. I think those are where the considerations go, is if the max with this team, even when healthy, is still fighting for the sixth seed. When you've had your guys, for Brandon to play the most games he's played since his rookie year, for Zion to play the most games of his career, and you're still fighting for the sixth seed, there are still some fundamental flaws that just growing up another year will not fix. And I think the only leverage you have is to decide which one of those two you're going to build around, because you have to have the best player in a playoff series. And in my opinion, the only guy on the roster who can be the best player in multiple playoff series currently on this roster is Zion Williamson.
I certainly agree with that last point. I think Zion's obviously had injury issues throughout his career, but we've seen, like, at his peak, he can be a top 15 player in the league, and he's still extremely young. I think I generally agree with you that I don't think Ingram maximizes Zion as much as Zion maximizes Ingram. I think it's kind of more of a one-way benefit there, and they definitely do help each other. But I think your second guy, if Zion, you know, you're planning on having Zion being this dominant on-ball guy, which he's shown he can be, and he can be really effective and efficient. He's one of the best rim threats in NBA history, really, especially like to start his career. But Ingram is best with the ball in his hands, and he's not a great defender. And though I think a lot of Ingram's could and would be mitigated if he shot the ball at the volume and efficiency that he did early in his Pelicans career. Not just that he was, you know, hitting 40% of his threes, but he was taking a ton of catch and shoots. His first 2 years as a Pelican, he shot 6.5 and 6.3 threes per 75 attempts, which is pretty good. But in this last year, these last 3 years, that's dipped to around 4 per 75 attempts, which I think is indicative of his one, just his preferences as a player. Like, Ingram has shown he's capable, but we know he's a player who likes to play slower. He likes to have the ball in his hands. He likes to be methodical, and that can really work. And especially in the playoffs, when the game slows down, that could be really effective. And I do think with Ingram's improvements this year as a playmaker, like, he is only 26, so it's not like he's done growing. He has been better passing the ball, especially as an on-ball guy this year. But I think that shooting would be the main key for him to really make this thing work. I think one of the most important and, like, underrated things for guys who aren't primaries is how they scale down, right? How are you impacting winning without the ball? And the ways that you do that, right? Passing, shooting, defense. Those are the ways that you and, like, you know, cutting, screening, finishing, other, like, stuff like that. But the main ways, right, are you're passing the ball, you're shooting the ball, you're defending. And while Ingram has certainly gotten better at a lot of those things, especially the playmaking, I think that next to a guy like Zion, the fit isn't necessarily ideal if we're looking at through the lens of, like, how can we maximize our odds of winning a title, which is the way that I think we should be looking at it always, especially at least from our point of view, right? Like, obviously we all know that front offices and teams have different goals. We always like to be like, oh, you know, every decision is made through the lens of winning a title. When obviously front offices have different motives, you know, they want to sell tickets. They want to win the game. They want to win games. They want to make the playoffs. And I think the Pelicans, as currently constructed, are a team that is going to make the playoffs for the next decade or however long they have this core healthy, which is great. And I think that's, like, an accomplishment. But I do think that there is a roster move or two that can be made, whether that's moving Ingram or just getting a bunch more pieces that are, you know, spacing and defending and just fit better around these guys. I think there's work to be done before, like, they're ready to contend. And I think that's fine. Like, they're still a fairly young team overall. Most of their core guys are young, and they have a lot of ways I think they can improve. But I do think those improvements need to happen.
Yeah. That the volume, you know, that's the thing is people, it's not about B.I. just being a three-point shooter, being a guy who turns that into, nobody's asking him to be late career Ray Allen where all you do is stay beyond the arc. But as you said, in the first two seasons of his career with the Pelicans, the season that he was named an all-star, the season that he put up his highest scoring average of his career, those came under up-tempo offenses. And a lot of what the Pelicans' stated goals are now are the things that Alvin Gentry and Stan Van Gundy individually wanted to do but could never get the mix of injuries and right players and buy-in, all the reasons that they couldn't do it. But philosophically, it's still the same. The idea that they brought James Borrego in on offense and the things that Willie wants to do defensively are the same principles that Stan talked about and Alvin talked about through the early parts of Zion and B.I.'s career his year.
Exactly. And I think, like, it's not as flashy, and a lot of fans especially, like, think that a guy who, like, takes a lot of tough shots and is getting tough shots is going to be a better scorer. And while Ingram's ability to make tough shots is obviously one of the best in the entire league, like, it would be better if he didn't have to do that so much. It would be easier. He'd score more. He'd be more efficient. And this is true for literally every single player, that the more
you get to the line, more.
Yeah,
that's another thing. As a small forward, he does not get to the line along the same rate as
that is team. Absolutely. And I have a stat actually that when Ingram is off the floor, so looking at on PBP stats, you can look at like all of the stats that change when a guy is on and off the floor. And the two that decrease the most with Ingram on the floor are, the first one is the massive change is second chance efficiency. The Pelicans are much worse on second chance opportunities with Ingram. And the other big one is free throw attempts. The Pelicans attempt two fewer free throws per 100 with Ingram on the court. That's not a massive difference, but I think it is true that one of the most efficient ways, like people will roll their eyes at this, right, is to get to the line, because free throws are free for a reason. And Ingram is obviously a great free throw shooter. He's been a great free throw shooter for most of his career. So I definitely do think, and it's not like he doesn't have the tools to get to the free throw line.
He does.
He can obviously do it. But I do think getting his free throw attempts up, or continuing to move those up, they declined this year, but they were pretty solid last year and the year before. So hopefully if he can keep working on that and focusing on that, that could be another avenue to more consistently efficient and, you know, less like cold streak proof offense, I guess.
And the thing about the threes that is curious to me is, look at his three-point attempts against bad teams. And look at his three-point attempts against good teams. Like, there's a big disparity there. He will take more, like, just step into threes. And yes, bad teams typically are worse defensively, but you see a different type of Brandon Ingram playing in those games. His approach is different. And I think that that's part of it, too. The thing that people talked about CJ this year was that CJ went in the offseason and figured out everything he was doing wrong in this offense. How do I adjust myself? Which shots are better for me to take? And his shooting profile reflects that change.
Oh, yeah.
We have not seen that. It's not to say it can't happen. And I'd be happy to be wrong. I would be happy if Brandon Ingram stepped into that role next year and said, I'm going to get up to 5 or 6 three-point attempts per game. I'm going to add 2 more free throw attempts to my game. You know, and play it that way. But, you know, we're just seeing that, yeah, this is a choice at some point. It's not just the way the defense is playing you. This is a choice in how you choose to play.
Yeah, and I think this is kind of the way that he's been for most of his career. And he's, like, it makes sense. He's very, very good at what he does. But when it's this being very good versus reaching a championship ceiling, these are the kind of, like, sacrifices and concessions you have to make. Like, you look at a team like Denver where – you know, guys like Jamal Murray or MPJ, or especially, like, I think of early career Aaron Gordon, who was like a handler and a creator for Orlando and has basically become like a play finishing big in Denver and has been phenomenal. He's been one of the best complementary two-way players in the league. And I think those are the kind of, like, sacrifices that great teams make. They know their role and they play within the scheme. It's rare that, like, you can have teams like these elite teams in the modern era who aren't like this, who don't have a diverse array of skill sets, who don't have really good complements to your stars. And I think that last thing, like the having a really well-built team around your stars, is the main thing the Pelicans have struggled with roster construction wise, in my opinion. It's not that they haven't, like, they've gotten great players and they've gotten players that can work together in the regular season. And again, we don't really have a fair playoff sample yet. So maybe this works in the playoffs and this is all for nothing and they win a title this year and we can be like, okay, cool. But that seems unlikely. And I think the scalability, the having guys who fit around your stars, is like the most important long-term roster construction goal. It's like, this, because like getting that 1A guy is the hardest part. And the Pelicans have done that. They have the hardest part out of the way. Most teams can't even get a guy like Zion. And the Pelicans have one. And someone who could theoretically be a really nice 1B or a 2 guy in Ingram if, you know, the mentality or the approach changes. So those are the kind of considerations that I think about when I'm thinking about the Pelicans going from a good team to one that is contending for championships.
Yeah. It's that simple. It's not any type of thing to say, I hate Brandon Ingram. It's nothing to be like, I think he's a terrible basketball player.
No,
to
me, I'm just a great basketball player. Like,
it's just, you know, I did this test with somebody and on one of my radio shows, and I was like, okay, let's just go with the teams that are ahead of the Pelicans in the standings and just in wins across the league. On which one of those teams would B.I. be the number one or the number two player? And if there's not a team above you, that would be the case. And I don't think that there is in the five teams above the Pelicans in the West. I was gonna
say, what is it? Denver, no. Minnesota, probably not.
No.
OKC, probably not. Oklahoma City,
no.
Clippers, no. Mavericks, no. So, yeah.
No. So if that's the case, you either have to have a much better support system, which the Pelicans, we agree, need to get better with their bench. It's not a complete bench.
Right. And it's good, but it's not complete.
No, it needs to be taller and it needs more ball handling. Those two things are definitive for this team because they get killed by big teams and they don't have enough people who can put the ball on the floor. But you get those things, okay. But for BI, it's about, are you willing to make the evolution? It's not about becoming, he doesn't have to become a guy who shoots 11 threes a game. I'm not asking him to be CJ in that volume. But you have to be a legitimate threat, and it can't be. I think the biggest issue I have with him with his threes is that he takes them from the spot that he shoots the worst from on the floor. Like, most of his threes come from the left wing above the break, and that is statistically his worst three-point shooting area. And that is a sign of just not awareness in your game. The growth of your game is knowing where not to shoot. You know, you talk to, when you see great scorers talk, they say, I know my eight spots on the floor where if I take it, I'm going to make it. And I think just sometimes in Brandon's choosing of his shots, that's a failure. That's part of the maturity. And he's got to take that next step. If you want the $50 million, the $45 million, if you want to be considered a regular all-star, because right now you're all-star adjacent. You know, that's the area where you live in. You're a cut below.
Right, like if a you fringe want to get to all-star next, guy, you know.
Yeah. So if you want to be that guy who's not a snub and you want to be constantly in that thing of why, you know, Brandon Ingram's an all-star, it's really four or five shots a game to change. Yeah. Over the course of it's one shot a quarter to change. Either and you're driving it, or you're taking
like,
three.
I think I want to, like, reassure them, like, these are, like, possible fixes. It's not like we're asking him to, like, you know, change something crazy. I think that can be, you know, if you're on the more optimistic side, like, room for, you know, for optimism, I guess. Like, there are easy ways that we can imagine, you know, if you and I can think of them, then certainly the smarter people in the actual front office have probably had these thoughts and discussions already. So hopefully in the future, and again, we'll see what happens in the playoffs. That's going to be extremely telling, more so than, you know, most of what we're getting late in the season. Obviously that matters, but what they do in a seven game series, how they game plan for their opponents and how the pieces are able to mesh together and end up working against the other team is going to be critical.
Ben, thank you so much. I think we broke this game down and about as well as we can. But let's definitely talk once we get past the regular season and we know who the Pelicans are going to be playing, sure, either we'll break that down, in the play or the first round of the playoffs.
Absolutely. We'll break that all down. Hopefully they can actually, you know, don't have a disaster in the play-in or anything. But well, let's not put that into the universe. They're going to make the playoffs, and we're going to have work to do for that.
I think they get two of these last three.
I think so.
I
think so.
I think either the Warriors game either becomes – I think they win tonight. I do think they win tonight. Because the Kings are coming off.
I think they'll beat the Warriors too, for sure.
And, you know, the only thing I just worry that either the Warriors – you always have the Steph possibility of him just going off that night.
Right.
And then with the Lakers, I think the Lakers, just size-wise, are a tough matchup for the Pelicans. Right. So one of those two.
Right. I mean, Lakers haven't been fully healthy either, right? Like, LeBron's had his illness stuff. AD missed that Warriors game where they got smoked. And the Warriors didn't even play, like, that amazing in that game. They just hit all their shots, which is, like, going to happen sometimes, especially for the Warriors. But all these teams are extremely beatable, and I think the Pelicans should be playing with and beating these teams.
Got to get CJ his rest tonight, though. If CJ's playing 42, 43 minutes tonight and then has to go chase Steph around tomorrow, that's going to be tough.
Yeah, a little much for him. Or any, really, but.
Yes. For Ben Fiver, I am David Grubb, and this has been the Bird Calls. Make sure you check out thebirdrights.com. Make sure you like, subscribe, comment wherever you can, if you're watching, if you're listening, whatever. But we will be back more frequently as we get into the playoffs, and check everything out. And Ben will be giving you more previews as well for not just playoff opponents, but teams, and looking at trends for the Pelicans wherever he is. And we'll also get with Ben later as we get close to the draft. He does a great job of scouting college players for us. So thank you again for watching and listening. And until the next time, let's go Pels.